The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. So Richard Palmer told me this morning that it was about time for us to have another movie review. Those are always fun. Another review on a movie that I haven't seen, just like the program we produced in March. I think it was the end of March where we pointed to a couple of articles about the Churchill movie that came out in June. Still haven't seen it. But that was the one, if you recall, where it was about the days running up to D-Day and how that this movie made it seem like that Winston Churchill was against the Normandy invasion. Andrew Roberts, he wrote a piece in response to this movie back in March. He said the only problem with the movie is that it gets absolutely everything wrong. This is what we based our review on. So I think it was pretty solid. But one of these days we'll have to produce a movie review show where I've actually seen the movie. In any event, Mr. Roberts says here, never in the course of movie making have so many specious errors been made in so long a film by so few writers. And we've got a clip, by the way, from Andrew Roberts that we'll play a little bit later on in the show, a distinguished historian. In any event, he says here, finally, this again is from March, the major error of fact, of course, is that although Churchill did indeed oppose an over-hasty return of Allied forces to northwest France in 1942 and 43, by the time of D-Day in 1944, he was completely committed to the operation. So that movie came out in June, I believe it was, and as Andrew said in his piece, it deserved to be a flop. I don't know if it was or wasn't. I didn't follow up on that. In any event, there's another Churchill movie coming out this fall called The Darkest Hour, and judging by the bad reviews coming from the left-wing media, it's probably going to be awesome. There's one left-wing review that said that this movie mostly plays as a rabble-rousing conservative fantasy in which it comes down to the powerful individual to single-handedly steer the course of history through his iron will. That's what this left-wing newspaper has to say. So it looks like it's going to be a pretty good show. The Darkest Hour tells the story of Winston Churchill's first few days as Prime Minister of Great Britain. Here's the 2-minute trailer for the forthcoming movie.
We must now select my successor, and it's only one man the opposition will accept.
He stands for one thing, and one thing only, himself.
Why have I been forced to send for Churchill? His record is a catastrophe.
Let me see your true qualities, your lack of vanity.
Yeah, my iron will.
Your sense of humour.
Ho, ho, ho.
Your Majesty.
It is my duty to invite you to take up the position of Prime Minister of this United Kingdom.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister.
The Germans have encircled 60 British and French divisions. We are looking at the collapse of Western Europe within the next few days.
How long have they got if we don't rescue them?
Maybe 2 days. We would need a miracle to get our men out.
You have the full weight of the world on your shoulders.
We're facing certain defeat on land, the annihilation of our army, and imminent invasion. We must negotiate peace talks.
When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
Nonsense. The only slippery slope.
Would you stop interrupting me while I am interrupting you?
We have before us many, many long months of struggle and suffering.
Even though many old and famous states have fallen into the grip of the Nazi rule, we shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender! For without victory, there can be no survival.
It's good stuff right there. That's coming out in November in the States. I think it plays here in the UK in January. But there's a film about those early days of Prime Minister Churchill's reign, his leadership in those dark days, the darkest hour. I mean, he was coming in to office in mid-May of 1940, right as the nation was in the midst of this impossible trial. Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, they were all just crushed by the Nazi regime. Hitler, in fact, had just captured Denmark and Holland, and France was on its way to surrendering as the German troops were moving closer to Paris. And then here comes Winston Churchill, and the island was next. The island was next on Hitler's list. And there was no one else to turn to for help. America had zero interest in getting involved in another world war, just a couple of decades after the end of the Great War. Britain was alone when Winston Churchill became prime minister. He was alone, and there was no realistic prospect of help coming from any direction. And at the time, as you heard there, even in that clip, there were quite a few British elites who actually wanted to negotiate some sort of surrender to the Nazi regime. They wanted to capitulate. They wanted to give in to Hitler's demands. Why should we keep fighting a losing war? Quite a few people thought. Or was it morally acceptable for Britain to send its young men to fight for a war they were going to lose anyway? Why not negotiate a truce, some kind of a truce with Adolf Hitler, even if it meant certain concessions? I mean, if it ended up saving tens of thousands of British lives, maybe that was the best course. That's what Winston Churchill stepped into. He had an impossible situation here at home. Forget about what he was facing abroad. And so he becomes prime minister, and he builds this coalition of rivals, basically. Neville Chamberlain, the man he replaced as prime minister. Lord Halifax, the man who wanted that position, prime minister. The labor leader, Clement Attlee, he was in the group. Arthur Greenwood, Archibald Sinclair, all of these individuals from the differing parties. And as I say, there were some strong voices, some strong opinions of surrender coming from Halifax in particular. We should have some kind of talks with Hitler and use Mussolini as the mediator of all people, Mussolini. We should acknowledge that Hitler had conquered Europe and negotiate some kind of a truce where he'll let us sort of fend for ourselves here on this island. Well, what about if we have to surrender assets? Malta, Gibraltar, the Suez Canal. So be it. That's what many thought. Well, Churchill, as you know, he resisted all of these calls to capitulate. Here he was in office just a few days. That's what this film evidently is about. Those few days, he comes into office. He doesn't exactly have many friends in government coming out of the wilderness years when he was like a pariah. The press hated him. Read the Winston Churchill booklet that we have. Read what he was going up against during the 1930s. He was alone politically. And now here he is thrust into this position. My father recorded a TV program back in 2014. This is almost 3 years old, where he built the show around this this book, The 5 Days in London. I'm not sure if this movie is based on this particular book. In any event, it's a book that's about that same time period, this impossible situation that Churchill was thrust into. Here's a sampling from my father's show, clip 2.
Foundation of that. I want to give you a few quotes from a book by John Lukacs, the Lukacs, and he titled the book 5 Days in London, May 1940, and he wrote about World War II and this sixth Holy Roman Empire. It all, he wrote about the rise of it and how it all led into World War II. Even though it was very destructive, there was one man that came on the scene, Winston Churchill, who was able to stand up to this sixth head in a way, in the beginning, that nobody else would. Nobody else would stand up to Adolf Hitler. So Herbert Armstrong came on the scene at the same time, and he explained all of that. He prophesied about it for years and years, and explained what it was all about. Just a few comments that critics have made about this book, Lukacs' scholarship, this is a quote, recreates with great immediacy the chaotic few days during which, according to the author, Hitler came closest to winning the war. That's from the New Yorker. Then another one says, eminent historian Lukacs delivers the crown jewel to his long and distinguished career with this account of 5 days, May 24 through 28, 1940, that could have changed the world. That's from the Publishers Weekly. It could have changed the whole world. In fact, Adolf Hitler could have conquered the whole world, and he came very close to doing it. That's why we need to learn lessons from what happened in World War II, and frankly, I don't think we've learned much of anything from it. And that's the problem we need to solve with a great immediacy today. Only Winston Churchill actually kept Hitler from winning the war very early on.
That's from my father's program, December 19th, 2014, the show about Revelation 17 and verse 10. He mentioned there in that clip I just played about the sixth head, the sixth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, and how that there was to be one final resurrection following World War II. Herbert Armstrong came along at the time of the sixth head, and God used him to warn the world, and he used Winston Churchill to save Western civilization. Hitler, as you just heard there, came so close to winning the war. What a crucial time period. Right there at the end of May, 1 week, 5 days in London, that changed the world because of Churchill's leadership, because of his watchman-like leadership. One more quote from that Key of David program, clip 3.
Here's a another quote from his book, this is about the War Cabinet. After 10th of May, 1940, the War Cabinet consisted of five men, Churchill, Halifax, and Chamberlain, and the two leaders of labor, Clement Attlee and Arthur Greenwood, who were brought into the coalition, making it a national government. So he had a very weak government surrounding him, and he had certainly a fear that that whole cabinet could fall apart and he could be booted out of office by Parliament or through pressure from the people. But he still had the courage to know that they had to fight on. So a real break, he wrote, between Churchill and the two eminent conservatives would have been disastrous. Had Halifax or Chamberlain or both resigned, there would have been a national crisis immediately reverberating in Parliament, and Churchill's position would have been gravely damaged, perhaps even untenable. So he had so much pressure, enormous pressure, to settle with Hitler. Well, let's make a deal. Let's negotiate, they were all saying, except Churchill. On 27 May 1940, Churchill said, he told Halifax in the War Cabinet, that any suggestion of an attempt to negotiate with Hitler would mean that Britain was stepping onto a slippery slope.
A slippery slope indeed. Negotiating with this madman. He was going up against a lot, Churchill was. There were just about a number of things. Hundreds of things that could have gone wrong. So much pressure at home, as my father brought out there in that show. Well, this decisive moment culminated in this cabinet meeting that my father referred to at the end of that clip, where he had those five members plus a number of other ministers and such. I think about 25 people in total. And Churchill gave the most important speech to those men, the most important speech of his career, really. I mean, given how close Britain had come to total surrender, this, as you've heard, I mean, this period of time, these few days, dramatically altered the course of human history. Churchill told that cabinet, he said, I have thought carefully in these last days whether it was part of my duty to consider entering into negotiations with that man. That man being Hitler. Okay, I've thought this through. I've thought it through carefully. He says, but it is idle to think that if we tried to make peace now, we should get better terms than if we fought it out. The Germans would demand our fleet. That would be called disarmament. Our naval bases and much else. We should become a slave state through a British government, which would be Hitler's puppet. I mean, that was the reality. That's what you would get by negotiating with this man. And yet, it's amazing, even in looking back on this with hindsight, it's amazing how many Brits in 1940 seemed... Well, they seemed like they were okay. I mean, people of the British Empire, quite a few of the elites, a number of those leaders surrounding Churchill thought that, well, if we give up Malta, if we give up the Suez, if we give up this, if we give up our navy and we can still live physically, then I think those terms are pretty good at this point. Churchill said, and I am convinced that every one of you would rise up and tear me down from my place if I were for one moment to contemplate parley or surrender. He said then finally, this most famous section of the speech, if this Long Island story of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each one of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. That was quite a rally cry, and it did stir up the members of his cabinet, his war cabinet. And the nation of Britain did rise to fight against the spread of tyranny and to go it alone against Nazi Germany. All because of the leadership of this man. And now think about that review. That left-wing review saying that this history, as it's put on the silver screen, it just plays to a rabble-rousing conservative fantasy in which it comes down to the powerful individual to single-handedly steer the course of history through his iron will. And, well, given what happened, how else can you explain this? I mean, the only thing that would have made it even better, of course, is... understanding God's will behind all of these events. But just looking at it humanly, that's what some of these these historians have to work with. What does this left-wing reviewer think it should, how does he think the story should be told? Well, perhaps he thinks we should retell the story and see how it was some kind of grand coalition that brought about this successful end. Look at the history, as some have done, honestly. Here was one man, a watchman, as he's called in Ezekiel 33, who stood up, and really, what he did, what he said, the action he took, it changed the course of history. This is from a speech, this clip here, from what he told his cabinet we're going to fight. Here's what Churchill had to say to the nation in May of 1940. Clip 4.
Our task is not only to win the battle, but to win the war. After this battle in France abates its force, there will come the battle for our island. For all that Britain is and all that Britain means, that will be the struggle. In that supreme emergency, we shall not hesitate to take every step, even the most drastic, to call forth from our people the last ounce and the last inch of effort of which they are capable. The interests of property, the hours of labor, are nothing compared to the struggle for life and honor, for right to freedom, to which we have vowed ourselves. I have received from the chiefs of the French Republic, and in particular from its indomitable Prime Minister, Monsieur Reynaud, the most sacred pledges that whatever happens, they will fight to the end, be it bitter or be it glorious. Nay, if we fight to the end, it can only be glorious. Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be. If this is one of the most awe-striking periods in the long history of France and Britain, it is also, beyond doubt, the most sublime. Side by side, unaided except by their kith and kin in the great dominions and by the wide empires which rest beneath their shield, side by side, the British and French peoples have advanced to rescue not only Europe, but mankind from the foulest and most soul-destroying tyranny which has ever darkened and stained the pages of history. Behind them, behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races, the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer, as conquer we must, as conquer we shall.
Stirring words there from Churchill, his address to the nation, saying, as he said there at the end of that clip, that the fate of the world, it rests on our shoulders, and we must conquer. Conquer we shall. So Britain was all in. Boris Johnson, in his book, The Churchill Factor, he said within a year of that decision to fight and not negotiate, 30,000 British men, women, and children had been killed. This is all just in the first year. Almost all of them at German hands. Weighing up those alternatives, a humiliating peace or a slaughter of the innocents. It's hard to imagine any modern British politician having the guts to take Churchill's line. Can you imagine someone choosing or making this same decision today? We are going forward in this cause. We are willing to sacrifice 30,000 people to fight this enemy. I mean, it's sobering when you think of the dark age that we're about to enter into again. That's the name of this movie, The Darkest Hour. And who is prepared to fight? Where are there leaders today that can lead this kind of charge? Johnson said Churchill had the vast and almost reckless moral courage to see that fighting on would be appalling, but that surrender would be even worse. And yet, how many would opt for surrender? If the movement to surrender was that strong here in the UK in 1940, almost 80 years ago, what do you think the people of Britain or the people of America, what do you suppose they would choose today? You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send in some comments or feedback to in response to this program or any of our programs, you can send emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Churchill's decision to fight on gained widespread support. But some had thought his military approach unnecessarily dangerous, including a member of his own war cabinet. Lord Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, had considered negotiating peace with Hitler to be the pragmatic solution. But in a series of cabinet meetings, Churchill stubbornly stood his ground and finally persuaded him that fighting on was the only option. It was one of the most decisive moments in the history of Western civilization. During the spring of 1940, Churchill's obstinacy, his desire not to take what appeared to be the easy way out, transformed him from being a pig-headed politician into a world statesman. Churchill outmaneuvered the appeasers in his government. He would never make peace with Hitler.
That's from a documentary titled Secrets of Leadership. And the voice you heard there was none other than Andrew Roberts. He's the one that wrote that piece that I quoted at the top of the show. About the movie coming out this past summer, where he said it was just a horrible. It got everything wrong. And that's him in this documentary talking about this decision to fight on and how it was the most decisive moment in the history of Western civilization, or certainly one of the most. He would never, ever make peace with Hitler. And now look. Look at where we are today, facing some of the same dangers, seeing some of the same kinds of hostilities. This piece at the Irish Examiner that I looked at this morning, Gary Oldman, I guess he's the actor that that plays Churchill in this new film coming out, Darkest Hour. And according to the Examiner, it says Gary Oldman has warned the world may be in the eye of the storm, similar to the one British Prime Minister Winston Churchill warned of ahead of the Second World War. I mean, here's an actor. I mean, as far as we know, he may think that Donald Trump is the one to worry about. But at least he's saying, look, I mean, there's some similarities. There's some similarities here. Oldman said he can see similarities between now and when Churchill was warning of Adolf Hitler's danger to the world while others wanted to appease him. He'd seen this pattern in war. This is quoting Oldman. He'd seen this pattern in war was unthinkable because of the cost of life, the financial burden that it would put on Europe, and then the depression, he told the Press Association. And then it quotes him as saying again, war was not very popular, but I think he, Churchill, was not just a great statesman, but somewhat of a prophet. That's from an actor. It was like he was a prophet. He predicted all of this. He said before the war broke out, look, we're just in a temporary lull. There's going to be another storm. I mean, that was this watchman's warning. And here comes a Hollywood actor saying, look, I mean, history could be repeating itself. It says finally in this piece, speaking at a premiere for the movie at Toronto International Film Festival, he added that Wright was not intending to make a film commenting on the contemporary world, but if it reflects on our current situation, then that's good. I mean, he just wanted to retell this story because he felt like it hasn't been told well enough, the director, the writer. And then here's the actor playing Churchill saying that this man was a prophet. He was like a prophet. Now look at what it says in Ezekiel 33. I've gone through this before, but it says here at the start of that passage, again, the word of the Lord came unto me saying, son of man, speak to the children of Israel or the children of your people and say unto them, when I bring the sword upon the land, if the people of the land take a man of their coast and set him for their watchman, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people. That's what Churchill did. You'll notice there too, I just read it, God brought the sword. God brought the sword to correct us, to correct our nations, to humble our people. We've been bringing this theme out quite a lot of late. It's God who controls the weather, as I've been covering. It's God who sends the sword. It's God who wants us to humble ourselves. It's God who's bringing this world to its knees. He has a controversy with the nations, as I covered yesterday. Well, the watchman, in the case of Churchill, during that World War II era, he saw the sword. He warned the world. He fought against tyranny. He saved Western civilization. And Hitler was heading up that sixth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. There's one more to come, and as my father covers in his booklet on Winston Churchill and in the Ezekiel Watchman booklet, or Ezekiel the end time prophet, he says there's no Churchill. There's no Churchill to save our nations this time around. You can read about that prophecy in Isaiah 3 as well. The dearth of leadership in our day. And even there, again, I don't have my Bible turned to that passage, but it says God takes them away, the leaders, the strong men. He's taken away the leadership. And so we don't see Churchills anymore. It's interesting, going back to May, Richard Palmer brought this out earlier this morning in an email exchange, this article about all of these Churchill movies and programs. There's a long series, I guess, on Netflix. I don't know much about that one, but it's called The Crown, an ongoing series, again, where Churchill is featured prominently. We talked a month or two ago about Dunkirk, the movie, which was a little underwhelming, but in any event, it wasn't about Churchill specifically. That might have made it a little bit better. But it's the same period. And then this one in June that needed to be a big flop. And then now the one coming out in November. Notice what it said in this Variety piece from back in May. It says, on the big and small screens, from Netflix's hit series The Crown to the upcoming Oscar season entry Darkest Hour, Winston Churchill is having a moment. The sheer number of current projects focused on the man who proved to be one of the most stalwart leaders in history is particularly noteworthy given the political unrest and upheaval sweeping the globe. I mean, given the dearth of leadership, given the political unrest, the title of this Variety piece from May, it says, the wealth of Churchill projects signals a hunger for leadership. Where are the leaders of yesteryear? Where are the leaders that led our nations out of the darkest hour? There's a hunger. There's a hunger for leadership. This Variety piece says, as the UK reels from last summer's Brexit vote, as France regroups in the wake of an intensely polarized presidential runoff, again, this is a little bit old, this story, this is from May, and as President Trump courts controversy with every new pen stroke and tweet, film and television dramas have found inspiration in the individual who stood up to fascism when no one else would. It's something actor John Lithgow, who stars in Churchill in The Crown, or stars as Churchill in The Crown, sees as a hunger for nobility in our leadership. And then it quotes this Hollywood actor, all these projects are underway, or were underway long before the storm clouds gathered. I don't know what he's getting at there. But we just seem to be at exactly the right distance from the Churchill moment to ruminate on his history, to look back and see how significant this was and how much you can learn from it. Yes, indeed. You don't hear this much coming out from Hollywood, of all places. Learning from history. It says further on in the article, McCartan wrote Darkest Hour on spec largely because he felt the story of how Churchill made his decision to stand firm and fight for the ideals and freedom of a nation rather than explore a negotiated peace with Nazi Germany, had never been satisfactorily told. He feels like this story has never been told. And you can see why it's needed. I mean, look at the way the left-wing media reacts to it. Oh, this is just a fantasy for conservatives. They love the fact that it was one man's iron will, and he changed the course of history. What a fantasy that an individual might actually impact the flow of events in this world. Well, that's the way it happens, more often than not. But not according to the intellectuals today or the scholars of today. Those out there saying that the movements, the trends, the ups and downs, it's all just sort of a foregone conclusion. And that in our heart of hearts, all of us, we just need to be, well, negotiating peace all the time. Talking to tyrants, trying to reason with the leaders of North Korea or Iran or wherever else. It says finally in this this piece, upon this decision, the fate of the world literally hung. That's McCartan, the creator of this Darkest Hour film, saying that the fate of the world hung on this decision, this period, May of 1940, just like Andrew Roberts said in that that documentary. One of the most decisive moments in the history of Western civilization. But now, returning back to this passage in Ezekiel, as my father has explained, there are no prophecies about a political watchman saving the people of Britain and the United States this time around. I mean, God will warn. God says it in this passage, Ezekiel 33. It says, "So you, O son of man, I've set you a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, you shall hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me." Now, this is no longer talking about the World War II period. The time setting here, from verse 7 on, it shifts to the last days. It shifts to the days we're living in right now. And this is another watchman, not chosen by the people. He's not someone that the people of the land have taken up from their coasts. This is someone God has chosen. This is God's messenger. It says in verse 8, "When I say unto the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die, if you do not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the wicked of his way and turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul." I mean, over and again, God says in this passage, you warn them from me. You tell them the truth, like I've said yesterday and on the program Monday. And that's what this world needs. That's what the preachers of the United States ought to be saying following a disaster. They ought to be saying, look, we better look at ourselves. We better look at the way we're living, because things aren't going right here. Things aren't working out for us. Why won't more preachers send you that warning, that message? Well, as I covered yesterday, because it's not popular. Because the people want to hear smooth things. And I mean, that was the case even in the 1930s. And they got it. They got that message, that smooth message coming from Chamberlain, waving that piece of paper in the air, everybody cheering. Hooray, hooray, we finally negotiated peace with Adolf Hitler. You give them warning from me. Verse 10 continues, "Therefore, O you son of man, speak to the house of Israel. Thus you speak, saying, if our transgressions and our sins be upon us, and we pine away in them, how should we then live? Say unto them, as I live, says the eternal God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live." It says, turn you from your evil ways. For why will you die, O house of Israel? I mean, you've brought this evil upon yourselves. And God here is talking about the death of nations. That's what we're facing. We're heading into a dark hour. That's what your Bible prophesies. And God is pleading. God is pleading. I read from that passage yesterday in Jeremiah 25, how he pleads with the nations, plural. He's pleading for us to turn. To turn from our wicked ways. And to seek his face in prayers, and to humble ourselves. As we've been reading over the last week from 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 14, why will you die, O house of Israel? Why will you die? Why choose this course when you could turn it around? Well, look at how this chapter ends, down in verse 28. This is Ezekiel 33. It says, "For I will lay the land most desolate, and the pomp of her strength shall cease, and the mountains of Israel shall be desolate, that none shall pass through. And then shall they know that I am the Eternal, when I've laid the land most desolate, because of all their abominations which they've committed, then they're going to know. They'll know it. I mean, they'll know it right as we're on the verge of collapse. They'll certainly know it when we're in the midst of these curses. But they're going to know. God's message was going out. It says in verse 30, this is the Moffat translation, "As for you, O son of man, your people are talking about you in the streets, at the doors of their houses, saying to one another, 'Come and let us hear what is the word of the eternal today.'" They're going to know about it. I mean, this message is going to get a lot of notoriety, a lot of publicity before it's all said and done. It may seem like it's almost drowned out by all the noise today. But curses are setting in, and some few are already beginning to sit up and take note. But this prophecy here says many, many more are going to be talking about you. That's what the meaning there for against you is really saying. They're going to be talking about you. They're going to be talking about the watchman message. They're going to be talking about this warning from God. They may do it somewhat secretively by listening to KPCG or by visiting thetrumpet.com or watching the Key of David. And eventually, I mean, there's a lot of people that aren't going to like the message either, because it's a warning from God. And it has to do with turning from our wicked ways. And that's the last thing we want to do. We want to hold on to those wicked ways. We want to celebrate those wicked ways. We want to continue in those wicked ways. Verse 31 says, "And they come unto you as the people come, and they sit before you as my people, and they hear your words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness." They like the words, even the strong words, even the words of warning, but they won't do them. They won't obey God's words. They won't make changes. And so it's going to take a total collapse of our nations for God to finally get through to the people of Israel. Verse 32 continues, "And lo, you are unto them a very lovely song of one that has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument. For they hear your words, but they do them not." They hear the words, but they won't do them. Well, God says to his watchman, "Work, you press on. Press on, don't be discouraged just because most reject it, just because most tune it out, or because most won't act on it." God says, "You send them warning from me, so that," as verse 33 says here, "and when this comes to pass, lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them." See, when all of the prophecies come to pass, then they will know. I mean, it'll be too late physically, but they'll know. And there are other prophecies that talk about quite a few people repenting of their rebellion against God, even during the Great Tribulation. That's how important this warning message is, this life-saving message. This message ultimately will turn hundreds of thousands, millions perhaps, many more than that if you project ahead on into the wonderful world tomorrow. But this message, in the end, it's going to turn mankind to God. This message, along with the correction that's coming. And that's what God really wants. He has no pleasure in seeing the death of the wicked or the death of nations. He just wants us to turn from our evil ways. "For why will you die?" he says in Ezekiel 33, "O house of Israel." You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll conclude today's show with a few emails. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Yesterday, I read through quite a few emails that came in response to Monday's Trumpet Brief, the 16th anniversary of 9/11. Speaking of the Trumpet Brief, the one that went out yesterday, it has Richard Palmer typed there at the end of the brief and my signature right above his name. So don't let there be any confusion about who wrote that. That was written by Richard Palmer. I told him this morning that he's gonna make me look smart. It was an excellent Trumpet Brief, and they inadvertently attached my signature to the end of it. But that is from your beloved Richard Palmer, and if you didn't read it, I'd encourage you to do so. And if you don't have a subscription to the Daily Trumpet Brief, make sure that you become one of our many subscribers. We're adding like 250 or so subscribers each week to that Trumpet Brief list, and you can get a subscription to it. It's all free. There's no cost for it, no follow-up. You can get it delivered into your inbox every day, every weekday, if you just subscribe at thetrumpet.com. In any event, I read through quite a few that came in response to Monday's brief. These here are a little bit older. They've come in over the last couple of weeks, most of them in response to other programs or Trumpet briefs from the last week and a half or so. Here it says, just a quick note to thank you for this recent program. It felt like such a fresh breeze coming in among all the bizarre and bad news. It's wonderful to stop and remember the outcome of all of this. It's so easy to get caught up and not give it its proper weight. It says here further, another one here from Maine, the Northeast United States. I can't state in enough words what a blessing it is to listen to the Trumpet Daily programs on a daily basis. The events God inspires to be covered and explained from His point of view on the program give a great deal of comfort. As I listen to these programs and hear God's answer behind the prophetic events taking place, I see more clearly why prophecy. It's all about declaring God the Father and pointing people back to God. Isn't God the Father, His character, His law and government, the answer to every problem and event this world is experiencing? It helps me see why the number one priority in God's mind is the restoration of His government on this earth, and why it needs to be firmly established in my home, my marriage, my family, my life. Sometimes it's really difficult, gut-wrenching, to hear about some of the sins going on, like those described in the program covering the Burning Man event. This world is wretchedly sick. How depraved we are apart from God. Apart from God, there's no real chance of a pure, happy, wholesome life with no kickbacks that cause so much anguish. This world has no idea what love really is. They refuse to see that a God who warns them for 90-plus years through Mr. Armstrong and now through God's church today, it refuses to see that what God's sending out is a message of love. Him warning us to turn away from such filth. And why we should turn away is love. It says further, setting aside Christ's sacrifice for 1 second, which itself is the ultimate act of love from God, if God is willing to warn us out of love for so long, what would He not do for us if we really took advantage, or rather really took His warnings seriously? Finally, it says, what mountain would he not move for us if we really want to live his way for a change? I pray for God's inspiration in the program and its contents often. Please know what a blessing and refreshment it is to have these programs daily. Another one here says, this in response to that trumpet brief my father sent out, I think a week and a half ago. Thanks for keeping us informed. Don't know what I'd do without the trumpet. It says, are your TV broadcasts starting again? Been missing them this summer. Looks like all the prophecies that you all are on top of are coming to pass. Your ministry is so exciting. Thank you so much, and God bless you all. That's from one of our Key of David viewers there in the States. And then another one here, a fantastic editorial, Mr. Fleury. That's in response, again, to my father's brief from a week and a half ago. I'm an SDA elder, but enjoy your magazine immensely. Time to start talking with our church to see what we share in common. Well, that may not go well. One final one here. I've been reading The Trumpet and The Plain Truth since I was 17 years old. I'm now 76. I feel the return of Christ coming more and more. I treasure you for your continued warning. You and your works will continually be in my prayers. If you'd like to email the program about anything, you can send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.